You're listening to the Art of Parenting podcast. I'm your host, Jeanne-Marie Pennell. Welcome and thank you for joining me. I created this podcast along with everything I do at yourparentingmentor.com to support and inspire you to be the best parent you can be. I know for a fact and from experience that parenting was never meant to be done alone. From conception to preschool, my mission is to give you the tools, strategies, and knowledge to embrace and elevate your parenting experience. I'm dedicated to supporting, inspiring, and guiding you to nurture your child's immense potential with as much joy and ease as humanly possible. Make sure to take time to check out all of the resources I have gathered for you in the show notes, as well as on my website, yourparentingmentor.com. And be sure to get on my email list so you do not miss a single episode and other products and events I curate specifically for you. And please do not hesitate to reach out if you have any questions, concerns, or feedback. A warm welcome to you and thanks for tuning in. Hello and welcome back to The Art of Parenting. This is your host, Jeanne-Marie Pennell. And today I have Steve Johnston with us, who is a father on a mission. And I am very excited to be talking to Steve about what's going on in his life, in his fathering, and all his big projects. So thank you, Steve, for making the time to be here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Wonderful. So as I always like to start, I like to have my guests define what the art of parenting means to them.
Ooh, the art of parenting. That's a great question. The art of parenting is kind of like the art of medicine, I think. I'm a practicing physician, and sometimes the art of medicine is the act of remaining calm while actually pooping your pants. And the same can be true for parenting. Is, you know, you just have to keep your wits about you and keep your calm about you, even though on the inside you're pooping your pants, so to speak, or you're very unsure of what you're doing, you're questioning yourself, but you just have to remain calm and trust your instincts, trust your gut, and ultimately the right thing will happen.
I love that. I love that because it's doing things even though they're scary and the unknown, and so true about parenting and a lot of things in life. So
it is.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and the work that you're doing today.
Yeah. So I am a dad in Gilbert, Arizona. I have two kids, 10 and 7, and I had a fairly normal dad life up until a few years ago when I got a diagnosis that my son has a rare genetic condition and is slowly going blind. And that obviously kind of upended my life and changed everything for me as a father. And we can dig into all the things that changed, but that was kind of the quick version of me as a dad and where I'm at right now.
And so I know that with this diagnosis, that must have been hard for everybody to accept and to hear. I know that you've done a lot of work to find a cure for your son, Luke. And I would love to know a little bit, first of all, maybe what that diagnosis was, and then what led you to the efforts that you're doing to, you created a nonprofit, you're doing a lot of work to find a cure. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So his diagnosis is called retinitis pigmentosa, which is a group of disorders, and it encompasses multiple different underlying genetic diagnoses. But retinitis pigmentosa is a inherited retinal dystrophy, which causes usually young kids or young adults to start to lose their vision. And ultimately, most people with retinitis pigmentosa become legally blind. The timeline for which that happens is different for every underlying cause of retinitis pigmentosa, and how fast it happens is very variable. So my son's underlying condition is called Bardet-Biedl syndrome, which is a ultra rare disease. There's only several thousand people in the US that have it. And he was diagnosed a few years ago, and he is expected to unfortunately lose his vision by the time he's a mid to late teenager. So it can be fairly rapidly progressive in his case. And so that really was part of the big impetus to, you know, change what we were doing in life, what we were, you know, what our priorities were, how we were living our life. And along with that, try to support research for a cure for him.
Wonderful. And what an amazing initiative that you're doing, not only for your son, but for many people who might have this diagnosis. And what were the precursors to this, you know, diagnosis? Like, what got you wondering what was going on? Was he saying he wasn't seeing well, or were you noticing things?
Yeah, so he, interestingly, so part of his syndrome, Bardet-Biedl syndrome, one of the things that goes along with it is called polydactyly, which is extra digits on your hands and feet, which he was born with. So right from birth, we kind of had a little bit of a, you know, an idea that maybe something was going on, but we weren't sure what. And there weren't any other things wrong with him at that time when he was born. You know, we had all kinds of tests, saw all kinds of doctors, geneticists, you name it, we saw them. And everything was normal for that period of his life. And then it wasn't until, you know, around the time that we got the diagnosis that we were, you know, we started to see some other stuff going on. So he had some issues with night vision, night blindness. Those are the earliest signs of stuff going wrong with kids, is usually the low light issues are very common. And then they start to have issues with their peripheral vision. So like the sides of their visual field start to come in, kind of like tunnel vision. And so some of those things started to pop up. And ultimately I recognized it very early, and we were able to go in and get the genetic test and see a pediatric retinal specialist and confirm that this is indeed what he has. Those are the earliest symptoms. And we've, in those years since now that we've had the diagnosis, we've noticed further progression of that, where he's had a much harder time seeing at night. And we can tell there are times where his visual field's not as good as it used to be. And things are progressing, unfortunately.
How is your son handling all of this? Because, I mean, this must be hard. And yet I understand that in a situation like that, like, he doesn't know any different, but it must still be like crazy to have this sensation of something is happening and I'm not able to see as well as I used to.
Yeah, it's obviously really hard, you know, that going back to that kind of opening statement of, you know, you kind of got to remain calm and, you know, figure out what to do, even though you're completely unsure of yourself and you have no idea what the right answer is, which is, how do you tell a 7 or 8 year old, hey, you're losing your vision and you're going to go blind someday? Like, what do you say? How do you tell them that in a way that they understand? What's an age appropriate way to tell them something like that? And so that was really the start of kind of that, you know, really tough parenting decisions, tough moments of uncertainty and what to do. And so at the time, we tried to tell it to him in as, you know, in as much of a way that we thought he could understand, with the level of maturity that he had at the time and what we knew about what his likely prognosis would be. So at first, he really didn't seem to even really react to it almost. It was kind of one of those things that just, like, he was like, oh, okay, you know. And I think at that level of, you know, at that age where he's kind of, you know, he thinks he can see okay, and he thinks he can see fine, and he doesn't know any differently. It's just like the way he sees is the way he sees. So that's just normal to him. And at that age, not having been exposed to anybody who is blind, or even really heard about it, talked about it in school or anything, you know, it's like, you know, blindness is not something that's necessarily talked about to kids that age at a like a very high detailed level. So he really didn't have any frame of reference for like what it would mean to lose your vision. So to him, it was just kind of one of those things that I think really was hard to process. And it wasn't until we started to have time go by, we were obviously talking about it a lot more, we were seeing more doctors and, you know, all those kind of things, that it just became more of a part of our life of, you know, that this is, you know, happening. And you could then see that he started to process and understand it. And there would become moments where we would be talking about something like that and he would start to cry. And it was like the first time that we had seen that. We really realized that, okay, he is processing this and he is now really, obviously this is setting in and he's aware of what's going on and he knows what's happening. And it took time. It was a long time from that initial diagnosis and when we told him to when we really started to see some emotional effects for him. So he definitely has those moments where I think that it's complicated and he doesn't know how to feel about it or what to do about it. He's obviously starting to see some of those effects progress more rapidly, where he, feels uncertain in certain situations because he can't see as well. So it's just very hard, obviously, and we're taking it all day by day and trying to just be as flexible and fluid in the parenting with him and giving him the support he needs to process all this and keep being a happy, well-adjusted, normal 10-year-old boy.
Yes, yes. And with this diagnosis, do you feel that you, or do you have support around kind of the whole psychological effect of accepting a diagnosis? I mean, both for you, the parents, and for your son, like, is there some support around that when you're navigating this type of situation?
Yeah, so we certainly try to gather as much information as we could from the kind of specialists. We went to see a specialty clinic who deals with this specific diagnosis and really has a lot of experience with, seeing kids and go through the progression. So they gave us a lot of valuable insights on, how to talk to them about it, what we should be kind of expecting to happen over the years and how we can kind of evolve our support. Shortly after getting the diagnosis, we obviously updated his kind of support plan with the school and telling them what was going on. And the school actually has, resources as well. They have vision support people who help kids who have visual disabilities across all the spectrum. There's a whole range of visual disabilities that kids could have. So they have vision therapists who work with kids on this stuff. So they've started to see Luke, and that gives him kind of a, additional level of support and education about it from a professional. And then certainly we have family, friends, people we've met in the community, all the kind of things. So we've tried to maintain as diverse and broad of a support network as we can to support everybody in this whole process.
Wonderful. And because I'm, I would think also all the attention that you're putting on, and this I'm assuming is your eldest son. You said you have two children. Is the second a son or a daughter?
It's a daughter.
A daughter. And how does she navigate all this attention that is being put on her brother and this diagnosis, or is she unfazed?
It's such an interesting thing to see, the way two kids process and react to the same information. So my son obviously was much more kind of like matter of fact about it, just almost didn't react at first, like I said. And we were kind of like, okay, all right, I wasn't expecting that. And my daughter, on the other hand, who's younger but has just this really high level of emotional maturity, who is very, she loves her brother so much. She thinks he's the coolest. He's everything to her. He is everything. And she was just worried about him from day one, just so concerned. And she's always been very concerned about him ever since with the diagnosis. And she seems to understand it almost better than he does in terms of what that means for him, what the kind of prognosis is, what it could be long term. And, it's just really interesting seeing the differences in two kids based on, just their personalities and who they are. And it was really interesting to see, but she's so worried about him and she loves him so much.
Mm, yeah. And it sounds like she's very empathetic and there to support him, which is beautiful. So I know you shared a little bit that this was kind of a big shift in your parenting, but how has life and parenting altogether in the light of your son's diagnosis changed for you and your parenting partner?
It's interesting. I should know better than anybody working in healthcare that tomorrow is not guaranteed. Anything can happen at any given time. But until it happens to you, you really don't necessarily feel that. And certainly getting a diagnosis like that was kind of my moment where it was like, okay, it's time to appreciate life. It's time to live it to the fullest. It's time to really make the most of every day. And knowing that limited time frame that we had with Luke that he could have, preserved vision in, and how quickly he could lose his vision that he has right now, we really wanted to really take the most of everything we could and see the world and experience things and do as much as possible and soak in as many things as possible. So like last summer, we spent the entire summer traveling. We just went everywhere and saw everything and tried to give him as rich of an experience as possible. And, you know, just in terms of appreciating life, I think that was just truly the biggest shift, that we just made that, you know, commitment that we were going to do whatever it took to try to make sure that he has all those opportunities that we possibly can give him.
Beautiful. So often these kind of hardships give us that lesson, right, of that we need to be grateful for what we do have. And sometimes I want to say I'm sorry that it had to be so hard to appreciate, but I'm glad that you are able to, and, you know, taking it that way. And so you kind of mentioned about creating this nonprofit, Erased Against Blindness. What is the work of the nonprofit, and what are your hopes with this nonprofit?
Yeah, so obviously getting this diagnosis, you go through kind of a grieving process of, you know, denial and anger and sadness and that whole typical process that you go through. And ultimately at the end of it, what came out of it was action, just the need to do something about it, to feel like that we were doing everything we could to help him. And we were told initially that there's no treatment, there's no real hope for a cure right now. There's nothing that we know of coming down the pipeline. So we're just told that this is going to happen and there's nothing you can do about it. And we were like, wow, that's really hard to swallow and accept. As a dad, as a father, as a man, as a physician, as all the things, it's just like, how do you accept that and just sit there and do nothing? And ultimately we decided we just wanted to do something, and we weren't sure what we could accomplish or how we could, you know, make a difference, but we're like, we're going to start a nonprofit. We're going to raise awareness. We're going to do fundraising. We're going to try to find research to support, and we will just do whatever we can. And early in the process, after starting the nonprofit, we luckily, after talking to multiple different researchers at multiple different institutions, trying to see if anybody's doing anything about this, we were referred to the UK, where there was luckily one research group who was already working on my son's kind of exact condition. And the therapy that they were working on, that they were utilizing, was based off of another therapy that had been recently FDA approved for a similar cause of childhood blindness. So it was kind of, the model was there, the treatment kind of framework was in place, the technology was there, but it just has to be kind of reapplied to each genetic cause, if you will. So it has to be redone for each underlying diagnosis. And so they were using that technology to try and treat my son's condition. And they had already done animal testing and animal models, and they were really far along in the research, and they were ready to try to fundraise for a human clinical trial. And that's when we linked up with them. And we were kind of both wanting to do the same thing for the same condition at the same time. And so the stars kind of aligned that we found like a real therapy that has real hope to cure his condition. But the one hurdle is fundraising, and has been for the last year and a year and a couple months now that we've been trying to do this. And it's very challenging to fundraise for a rare disease. And it's even harder to fundraise for a disease that has essentially a one-time treatment cure, where they can treat it and then this would be cured. There's not some ongoing medication or therapy or anything that needs to be done long-term. So there's some financial hurdles that, you know, are caused by that in the kind of biotech pharma world. So we've been fighting that battle for the last year, and that's been our mission, is fundraising for this potential clinical trial.
Amazing. Amazing. And are you feeling hopeful? I mean, is it share maybe what your hopes would be, because you've got people listening and probably like on the edge of their seat, like, how can we help? Like, what is your hope? I guess you said it clearly. It's to raise funds for this clinical trial, but how are you fundraising? Like, how are you trying to bring awareness to people around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So my first and biggest thing that I always say is that everybody can make a difference. It doesn't matter how many resources or how little resources anyone has, everybody can make a difference, whether it's just sharing the word and telling people about it. That's obviously hugely important for us. If people don't know about it, they can't help. So that's one of the biggest things that I always emphasize upon people, is even if you have nothing, it does not matter. Those type of gestures make all the difference in the world for us. And even a dollar is a huge difference, because if we need $10 million to fund this clinical trial, if 10 million people all put in a dollar, we're there. That's, you know, that's 10 million people all coming together to make their voice heard and make their voice count and come together to do this beautiful thing to save childhood eyesight. So there's really no limit to how much, you know, difference somebody can make with even just a dollar. With a dollar and then a reshare, man, we can really make so much difference. And that's kind of the message I've been trying to spread for hope for anybody, even though, you know, this is a, you know, challenge and this is a hurdle and we have a lot of work to do. We've really been gaining success in the last, I'd say, 3 to 6 months. So there was that kind of slow startup phase of just trying to get our feet under us, get the, you know, get the nonprofit up and running and get a name for ourselves. And then now we've been snowballing. We've been kind of getting out there and, you know, having some fundraising successes, and those are building on each other, and it's really starting to come together. So at any given time, we probably have some sort of fundraiser running. We do raffle style fundraisers or giveaways, as they're called, where, you know, we offer something of value for people and they can enter to win, and the money is used to support our nonprofit and they get a chance to win something, which we found to be very successful for getting people interested in our nonprofit and reaching people that wouldn't otherwise have known about us or heard about us. And so we always have something like that going, which is a really great way to support us. And one thing I'll say that makes us unique as a nonprofit is that we're entirely family run and we have no executive salaries. We don't take any money ourselves in any of this. It's entirely run with the intention and goal of, you know, raising money for this clinical trial, and everything we raise stays in the nonprofit for that purpose. Unlike, you know, some kind of big nonprofits you might hear about where the CEO takes millions of dollars and all this type of stuff, that's not us. We're, our only goal and our only mission is to raise money for this clinical trial. So that's how we've set up our nonprofit, and we're really proud that we can, you know, do this and kind of give the time and effort to it, and we will be successful eventually. So that's our that's what we're working towards right now.
Beautiful, beautiful. And when you say the clinical trial, like how many children would have access to this clinical trial?
So it would be something that's going to be done worldwide. So there's we have partnered with the Mayo Clinic here in the U.S. through my kind of medical connections and resources. I got a research team at the Mayo Clinic to agree to do the clinical trial whenever it becomes ready, like whenever the funds are there and we have all the backing for it. So we would have a, you know, clinical trial site here in the US at the Mayo Clinic. And then the UK group, where the research is already being kind of conducted, the basic science research, they would have a clinical trial site in the UK. Worldwide, initially, we would probably be, you know, 5,000 people or so that initially would get involved in the clinical trial. And the impact of it goes beyond just this disease, though, because like that other disease being treated that kind of spawned this model, every single one of these conditions that gets an FDA-approved therapy kind of paves the road for all these other ones to become more attainable to find a cure. The FDA is really one of the hardest hurdles in how stringent they are with these treatments, because it's a new type of treatment. And it's only been done once before. So once we do it, it would be a second time. And then that would make it easier for the third person to do it. And so the hurdle and the bar that would have to be overcome to approve these treatments in the future becomes easier and easier. So it's super important to start getting these successes through and to keep having more, because there's hundreds of thousands of kids who have retinitis pigmentosa due to all these different underlying, you know, conditions, but each condition needs its own therapy, basically. So there's a lot of just logistical challenges. So that's really where we want to make a big impact is, you know, once we get this one approved, keep pushing forward and keep making those inroads so that these can become FDA approved more readily for other conditions as well.
Amazing work. Really, really beautiful. And I know that you, when I was reading about you, you're also an Ironman athlete. And I just was wondering, like, how has that helped you in this whole kind of, you know, parenting journey? Because I guess I'm assuming that, you know, being an athlete at this high of a level kind of you have to work on your mindset and this perseverance and all of this. And I feel that that goes well hand in hand with what you're having to deal with in creating this nonprofit and finding a cure for your son and so forth. Do you see that helping you?
Absolutely. So, you know, Ironman training, triathlons in general, they're really more of a mental challenge than a physical one almost. And the interesting thing is I was not a Ironman athlete before any of this. I chose to do it after getting this diagnosis, and I chose to do it alongside starting the nonprofit for the very reason of that, what you talked about, which is the mental perseverance, the mental toughness, how to overcome challenges, how to do hard things. Because how can I, as a dad and as a role model, ask my son to do all these hard things, you know, learn how to, you know, walk with a cane or read Braille or just overcome the mental challenges of the thought of losing your vision and everything that's going to come with that, if I can't, you know, rely on any experience of my own and be like, this is how I got through tough situations, these are the hard things I did. So choosing to do Ironman was a specific choice in that, because I wanted to do something that I knew that I wouldn't enjoy, that would be hard for me, that would suck really bad. And then I could use that as an example and be like, look, this sucked and I hated it and it was awful and I got through it anyways. And this is how I did it. And that's exactly why I chose to do it. I had an example, my co-parent, Christina, she's an accomplished Ironman athlete. So I kind of had seen that world and knew what she had to do to, you know, become what she was at. She's done 3 or 4 Ironmans now. So she's a very accomplished athlete with all this. And so we both chose to continue to do it as a, you know, fundraising and awareness thing for our nonprofit, as our name implies, a race against blindness. We were racing against time and racing against my son losing his vision. But we wanted to take that play on words a little further with quite literally racing against blindness. So we have used that Ironman racing as one of our kind of awareness and fundraising things. So multiple different reasons why we're doing it and multiple different kind of meanings behind it.
Yeah, no, and I just wanted to hear it from you, that just that whole, you know, the mindset for me is so important. Like when you were, you know, earlier you had said about, you know, taking action and just like you have to do something, and you know, you've done a lot, because creating this nonprofit and becoming this athlete and all this is pretty amazing. So kudos to you.
That's, well, thank you.
Yeah. Anything that maybe I didn't know to ask that you want to add to this conversation for our parents listening to, you know, whether they might fear to get a diagnosis or they've just had a diagnosis, like how do you navigate all of that? You know, any words of wisdom for them?
Yeah. So I would say to the, you know, one group of people, which is maybe they're just, you know, they're going through life and they've got, you know, healthy, happy, normal kids right now, is to try to start doing things that might prepare them for challenges, you know, find those little safe places for them to fail, find those opportunities to give them a little bit of hardship where they can overcome some things, whether it's enrolling them in martial arts or some challenging sport, and let them have those little micro failures that they, you know, hit a hardship and then they get through it, and you're there to, you know, keep the safety blocks up on one side or another so they can safely fail, and then let them learn. If you're a parent going through this, if you've gotten some tough diagnosis, any range of diagnoses that could exist, you know, it's really about support at that point. It's really asking for help, whether it's for yourself, you know, getting a therapist, which I've had a therapist to help me kind of manage and negotiate my feelings and, you know, help me get through all this, or getting, you know, support for your child who's going through whatever they're going through, getting help, getting support, asking for help, which is super hard, especially for the dads out there. I know how hard that is. It's the absolute most vital thing that you can do. So I would just say, make sure you have that support network in place for you and the kids, and you'll be able to get through whatever it is you're going through also.
Thank you for that. Yes, thank you for that. And I always love to kind of circle back for kind of a more personal question, if I may. And you mentioned that you have 2 children, 10 and 7. If you were to go back maybe 11 years ago when you and your partner were first expecting your child, what wise words would you have liked to hear or be told, or maybe that you would tell yourself today, knowing all that you know?
Gosh, that is such a good question. It's one of those things, like I have zero regrets, if that makes sense. Like everything happens for a reason in the world, and you You know, I wouldn't change a thing in terms of my kids and who they are. As a parent, to prepare myself, I would tell myself to, you know, start expecting the unexpected, doing those same things that I said that you should do for your kids, which is start challenging yourself, start, you know, kind of mentally preparing yourself for all the unknown that lies ahead, because challenges are coming for all of us at some point or another. And the more that we do to prepare ourselves to be able to take those head on when they happen, I think the better we are. So I would have said, you know, start doing some Ironman type stuff now, like start, you know, sharpening those mental toolkits like now, and then you'll be much better prepared for all that's to come when you least expect it, because it is coming for all of us, and it's going to come in different ways, different shapes and sizes. But that's that would be my one thing I would teach myself, to better prepare myself for what lied ahead.
Thank you for that. Thank you. Well, Steve, this has been delightful. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story and, you know, this adventure that you're on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's been a pleasure to be able to talk about what we're up to. And I really appreciate it.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Art of Parenting podcast. And if you did, please share it with your loved ones and make sure to leave a review so it can get heard by many more. And remember, if you've got a question, let me know. I'm here for you. Till next time.